thanks, Rupesh. And yeah, thanks for giving me this opportunity to talk about this new telescope that we built. So I thought I'd start out by showing you the image over the telescope. This is a live image, so, well, it's about 30 seconds delayed. So this is the image at 40.9 megahertz. On this panel, we have the total intensity, and on this panel is circular polarized intensity. And so what you can see, well, the sun is rising, so we can see the sun at 40 megahertz. It's not the brightest source in the sky. Always, it is, of course, when it's flaring, the active sun is billions of Janskis. The quiet sun is kind of comparable, a little bit brighter than Virgo A, around 1,000 Janskis. This diffuse emissions, the North Galactic Spur. This bright thing over here is interference on the horizon. So, you know, interfering sources, man-made interference, tends to come from the horizon, so we tend to see it all around on the low. We are looking at pretty much the whole sky, about, you know, two pi steradians, a little less than two pi steradians. Gas and Sig are over on the horizon. And there's been a little transient flipping around over here, but it's shy now, not showing up. Okay, so we just run that live. It's just for fun. It also is a quick diagnostic. As a director, I can look and see whether we're up, and if we're not up, I can harass the engineers and why is the telescope down. So here's the array. So here we've been talking. We've been at high energy for the last several days, and now we're going to the other end of the spectrum. We've been talking, you know, Fermi meets Jansky. Jansky was working at 20 megahertz, and that's the sort of frequency range that we're in here. So we've, radio astronomers ran away from the low frequencies in pursuit of higher resolution and better sensitivity and to get away from the ionosphere. But now we can go back down there. We have more techniques at our disposal and digital processing that we can do. And so now we're going back down to the bottom end of the electromagnetic spectrum because there is a lot of interesting stuff to do. Yeah, so it's virtually great, wonderful facility here that works from 1 to the gigahertz. And then here we are located at the VLA site in the central square mile that NSF owns. And we're this sort of different looking telescope. It's another array. It's an array of just little dipoles. And then we put all these dipoles together and synthesize about a 100-meter dish is our effective collecting area. Now, this is meant to be on the road to something much grander. This is the state of New Mexico here, and all these little dots are places where we thought we might put an LWA station. So in the long run, we've built this one. And our intent is to put lots of these stations out and then do a synthesis of all those stations, and that would get us arc-second resolution, which would be, you know, more comparable with other wavelengths. And also, you know, sub-millijansky sensitivity. The cost to do that would be about $1 million per station. We don't have the funding at the moment to do that, but we did end up with a pretty capable 100-meter antenna telescope. So our frequency range is from 10 to 88 megahertz, and the dipoles are all dominated by galactic noise, so you don't need to bother to cool anything because the sky is quite bright. But you do need to make sure that all your electronics perform better so that you are limited by the galactic noise and not by anything in the instrument. So we're more than 4-to-1 galactic noise dominated. The antennas don't move, they're just looking up at the whole sky, and then as some wave propagates from some distant source, we just insert the appropriate delay and phase up all of these dipoles in one direction. And in fact, if you have enough electronics, you can phase up in multiple directions. We can phase up in four directions at once, and we get wide bandwidth, 16 megahertz bandwidth, And we get two tunings for each one of these four places in the sky that we want to look. And we get both polarizations. The sensitivity is about 5 Jansen, down to about 5 Jansen in 1 second. The images I were showing you there have RMS noise levels around 30 Jansen, 40 Jansen, actually dominated by their 5-second integration. So in principle, the noise should be less, but they're dominated by confusion. Just all these different sources within the low resolution element. Our resolution is kind of makes Fermi look good. We have a few degree resolution at the high frequencies, and then that goes down to almost 30 degrees at the bottom of our band. And really just kind of seeing the whole sky, or a good fraction of the sky. Okay, let's see. We have an outrigger we use for calibration. The science emphasis, why did we build this? There's a pretty broad science case. Transients, the transient radio sky, pulsars, looking at the sun, looking at Jupiter, ionosphere. And there may be, I think, some interesting things we can do with blazars as well, especially very core-dominated objects that are varying. Okay. The reason we put this out in New Mexico is because there's very low population density, so the interference environment is pretty benign. We have the FM band up here around 90 megahertz, so don't try and work it there. And then at the bottom end of the band, you get a fair amount of communications and ham radio and all sorts of different stuff that just bounces off the Earth's ionosphere. You would get this anywhere in the world, so it's really unavoidable. This stuff at very low frequency. But you can see that we have quite a good wavelength range to look at. The signal, by the way, that you're seeing in here, if you're not familiar with that, is galactic noise, right? So it gets brighter, the signal gets brighter here up to about 30 megahertz because the sky is getting brighter, and then below 30 megahertz, the instrument response is dropping off. And that's what causes that shape there, that bump. As the galaxy goes over the galactic center, gets to a higher latitude, the sky gets brighter. So this is a real diurnal signal. Okay, so here's what the antennas look like, and this is the electronic shelter in the background. So the signal comes in, there's a little front end here that amplifies things up a little bit, and the cables are all carefully buried, and then go down here and then enter into that electronic shelter. Of course, we have to be very careful. We've gone to such trouble to be in a nice radio quiet place that we don't want to pollute it ourselves. We have to make sure that everything is buttoned up and that we are not, the brightest thing that we see. Right. So you have to, we have to have very good shielding. We do. And boxes inside boxes. Let's see. Show you some more boxes. Right, 520 cables come in here, coax cables basically, and then go into this rack with the pretty blue lights. That's our analog receiver, so we gain the signal up, and then we pass it over to the digital processor, and this is where the beams are formed, and we also take a little snippet of bandwidth from every dipole and pass it to another machine, which makes those all-sky images, where we go ahead and cross-correlate every dipole with every other dipole. So when we do that cross correlation with just 100 kilohertz of bandwidth, we make images of the sky. This is just an early set I chose. So we have 10 seconds to make each one of these images using just 50 kilohertz of bandwidth. So this is our all sky imaging mode, and showing you what the sky looks like at different frequencies. We can see it anywhere from 10 to 88. So here's low frequencies. We're very sensitive to the galactic emission from the galactic plane. Jupiter is very strong. The sun, which is very well indicated here, the sun's right over here, is basically, you don't see it. It's not very bright at these very low frequencies when it's not active, the quiescent sun. Then if we go up to 34 megahertz, galactic plane emission drops off a bit. Now we can see the sun. We don't see Jupiter. These were all taken one after the other, 10 seconds, 10 seconds, 10 seconds. And then we get up to 74 megahertz, you're left with Cass A and the sun. And these images are a bit crude because we took those several months ago before we had fully shaken out, and we're still improving on the calibration. So even at 74 megahertz now, we can see galactic plane emission pretty well. This is the other mode, is we can form beams in the sky. So this is just an instrumental test. We formed a beam and let Cygnus drift through it. The spikes over here are interference, so we got a little burst of interference. This was done at 74 megahertz, just late in the afternoon, I think. And just with about a megahertz of bandwidth, we're still in the process of widening that beam in bandwidth. Okay, this just shows that we can point two places at once. So we're pointing in front of Cygnus A and letting it drift through, and then we're pointing in front of Cass A and letting it drift through at the same time. So this little RFI spike here is the same as this RFI spike right here. Quick comparison to other instruments you may have heard of. The VLA operated at 74 megahertz, and it still does have these sessions during A and B configuration. They string up some dipoles. And that works moderately well. So we're sort of similar sensitivity R1 LWA station with the 27 VLA dishes. And then another instrument that is operating at these low frequencies is LOFAR. LOFAR has a high band and a low band. This is just the low band, which overlaps with our frequency coverage. And this is all of the LOFAR. This is, I think, 36 LOFAR stations. So they have fewer dipoles per station, but they have a lot more stations. So we end up sort of comparable in sensitivity. We do a little better at the low frequencies. They do a little bit better close to the resonant point of their dipoles at 60 megahertz. Okay. So, and of course, LOFAR, so advantages, LOFAR has a higher resolution because they have the stations are spread out over 100 kilometers, so we envy them the resolution. But they have they're not able to see as much of the sky. We're at 20 degrees lower declination latitude, so that we can see lower declination sources. This is an observation of a pulsar. In fact, this is one of the first pulsars that Jocelyn Bell discovered. So you know, clearly we're a we should be able to do a lot of interesting pulsar science. So here you see a couple of good pulses. And we were just putting a beam on the pulsar and letting it drift through the beam over a period of a little over 10 minutes. So we anticipate doing lots of pulsar studies. I think those are interesting on the connection with Fermi. There's a clear connection with Fermi. On the pulsar side, there have been all these new millisecond pulsars discovered, and before Fermi, there was just one radio quiet gamma ray pulsar, but now there's a whole class of 36 pulsars that aren't pulsing in radio, and that's a good puzzle. Why is that happening, and what can we learn about the gamma ray beam and the radio beam? And at these low frequencies, they haven't been looked at, so this is high on our list of things to do, is go and hit these 36 radio quiet pulsars and see if they really are radio quiet down to if they're really radio silent or not. Another project, maybe just mentioned in passing, if I can go back, the crab, of course, is a strong source, a very strong high energy source, and one of the things we want to do is look for giant pulses. The crab emits giant pulses at low frequencies, and to even do that at the sort of contemporaneous with Fermi would be, I think, quite interesting. Okay, so might be running behind, so I don't want to spend too much time on the science overview. This in black are the topics that sort of, the four main topics that we pitched the long wavelength array for: acceleration of relativistic particles, so looking for cosmic accelerators, which this conference is interested in, has had a lot to say about. We can also do studies of cosmic evolution, the high redshift universe. There's a couple of projects ongoing with the telescope to look for hydrogen redshifted out of redshift 30. I was afraid of that. anyway, so and and then transient, you know, the transient universe. So there's the LWA1 subset here is in red. I guess the point is, you know, there's lots of interesting things that we can do with this 100-meter facility, and maybe people here have even more ideas, which I'd be happy to talk to folks about. I must press on. I want to talk a little bit more about this all-sky imager that we have. So there's a little cluster, and that's what that's out at the site, and this little cluster is what's making these images in the sky. So it's running, you know, it's doing the correlation and the imaging pretty much in real time. What we don't have yet is the automatic transient detection and the, you know, triggered alerts so that we can, you know, follow up and get on it. We're working on that, and also on improving the calibration. We just implemented a calibration to improve the circular polarization. Just, you know, very briefly, basically, we haven't really had this ability to look at the whole sky all the time to these kind of flux levels. So there have been some experiments in the past, but we're just, you know, many orders of magnitude better now. And with just a month of observations, you know, we will do put, you know, much, much better limits on bright and rare transients. And there's a number of things we think ought to be emitting, such as, you know, so Jupiter is a really strong emitter. We see that. I want to show you a movie. And so looking for hot Jupiters, and there's other, you know, magnetar giant flares, GRBs, etc. But I want to get to my movie. So this is just taking the images, and we're sort of flashing by them, flashing through them. Here you see an interfering source on the horizon. Let's see, Jupiter's rising. We got the galactic plane here, Sig and Cass. Oh, and now there's this other source that is that we detect there in total density and in circular polarization. So there's this little guy, and it looks like it's moving with the galactic plane. So that might be, you know, an interesting sort of transient. Here you see Jupiter flaring away. Pretty much expected behavior, often easier to see in circular polarization because it's strongly circularly polarized. These are coherent emission mechanisms at these very low frequencies. We're at 26 megahertz here. So I think they're you know, optimistic that we could see some nice discoveries from this. This if we see, you know, a bright transit, it has to be very bright, right? It's got to be hundreds, thousands of Janskys for us to get a very good signal. We see some of these things. We don't know, to be fair, whether that's an exciting new source or whether it's you know, something reflecting off of a plane, that, you know, so some radio station reflecting off of a plane that's flying overhead. But if it's moving with the galactic plane, if it's just out of the galactic plane and it's moving with the sky sidereally, then that's a pretty good bet. So I'll just close with a summary that LWA1 is operational, and I think there are many opportunities for discovery in pulsars and transients, cosmology. It's also an early example of people have been talking about large N array. Let's build large N. Let's have, you know, 500 elements or something. Well, we actually have 256 elements, so that's pretty large. We have 32,000 baselines. We've already broken some interferometer packages. We just can't use them because nobody ever intended them to have this many elements. You can find images in the sky at this webpage if you're interested. And the last point I'd like to make is that if you're interested in interferometry at low frequency or in the sort of stuff that DLA does, or ALMA, then we're up to 13 now. The 13th Synthesis Imaging Workshop will be taking place 29th of May through the 5th of June of 2012. Tell your friends. Tell your friends. Right, yeah, so the wide-R correlator is quite capable of doing that, and we do plan to investigate that. You know, I've been talking to Dale, who's the new director of the DLA, and Dale's quite interested in that, and transients in particular. I mean, so we could organize some sessions. So there's sort of two ways to use it. There's postdoc probably to figure it out, and a little help from some engineers. And then there's just, coordinating observations where, like, we see a transient trigger the BLA follow-up. We're interested in that, too. One could write a proposal. What about the ionosphere?
I mean, low frequency, right?
Oh, yeah, why do we cut off at 10 megahertz? Yeah, so the telescope is cutting off at 10 megahertz, but there's a reason to do that is the ionosphere has a cutoff, and it ranges, and it holds, depending on solar activity and day and night, you can, in fact, go off and down to 5 megahertz at this particular site, and the ionosphere is still transparent. At some point, you hit the plasma frequency cutoff, and that's it's game over. But we sort of figured 10 megahertz was, and it's tough enough to build a telescope that's sensitive over a decade of frequency. So 10 megahertz is good enough. Yeah, so 1 million is a pile part cost for one of our stations.
So your station,
yeah, we spent $1 million roughly, pile of parts and some installation.
How many?
Total plans 53. We'd be happy with another 15.
Thanks, Nick. Okay, well, the final question.